From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today we examine the 2012 Farm Bill and what it could mean for Iowa producers, the economy, and the environment. Last Friday at the Iowa State Fairgrounds in Des Moines, the U.S. House Committee on Agriculture held a public hearing to hear from local producers and other interested parties in advance of the 2012 Farm Bill. This hour, we'll hear from some of the participants, including a report from Iowa Public Radio's Rob Dillard. Also, Bruce Babcock, director of the Center for Agriculture and Rural Development at Iowa State University. An in-depth look at the 2012 Farm Bill after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Friday, at the Iowa State Fairgrounds in Des Moines, the U.S. House Committee on Agriculture held a public hearing to get input from local producers and other interested parties in advance of the 2012 Farm Bill. In this hour, we want to examine the 2012 Farm Bill in depth and see what it could mean for Iowa producers, for our economy, the environment, and even for those of you asking, why should I care? First of all, joining us to start off this hour, Iowa Public Radio's Rob Dillard, a person who certainly does care about the Farm Bill. In fact, he covered it in the public hearing on Friday. Good afternoon to you, Bob. Rob.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Tell us about the gathering last Friday. Who was there? What was the atmosphere like?
Well, it was in the cattle barn at the Iowa State Fairgrounds. So if you're familiar with the fairgrounds, you can picture the setting for this first public hearing on the 2012 Farm Bill. For the most part, the farmers who testified were traditional grain and livestock farmers, and there were some special interest groups also testifying before the committee. A conservationist from the Conservation Districts of Iowa was there, a food processor. In this case, it was Warren Erickson from Anderson Erickson Dairy Company here in Des Moines, a representative of private crop insurance agents, and a chairman of a renewable energy group. We even had a livestock auctioneer testify before the committee. It was the entire U.S. House Agriculture Committee, chaired by Colin Peterson of Minnesota. The ranking minority member of the group is Frank Lucas of Oklahoma. Iowa Congressman Leonard Boswell and Steve King both serve on the committee. Jim Costa from California, Stephanie Sandlin from South Dakota. Iowa Congressman Tom Latham was also at the meeting. He's not a member of the Ag Committee, but he is a member of the House Committee on Appropriations, and so he was representing that group.
In observing the proceedings, Rob, did you see any overarching themes?
Well, one thing that is really driving a lot of conversation in the ag industry these days, and it's coming from former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, who's now the U.S. Ag Secretary. At almost every stop, Mr. Vilsack talks about the decline of life in rural America, the disappearance of family farms, the population losses in rural areas, the poor economic conditions in the countryside. And so some of what was said at the hearing Friday had to do with how do you attract and encourage young farmers to enter the business? How do they pass along, in some cases, 100-year farm operations, multi-generational farms from one generation, an older generation for the most part right now, to their children coming up? And so there's requests in this next farm bill for some incentives that might encourage young farmers to begin farming the land and handle the high costs of land and machinery and insurance. It's all daunting for these young farmers. These people want government commodity price supports. They say they are needed. They need some safety nets to guard against any failures on the farm, some poor crop seasons. They need just a lot of help in getting loans and support for capital investment.
I understand, though, when you say things like incentives, that Chairman Peterson said there won't be any money really available for extra things, will there?
Oh, that was the overriding message coming from the chairman at this meeting. He said there is just not a lot of government money available for the next farm bill. They're not going to be able to increase loans. They're going to have to seek creative ways to make it possible for the next generation of farmers.
Is there any way for the public to comment, for our listeners to have their opinions heard as this 2012 Farm Bill gets formed?
You can go to the website of the U.S. Ag Committee, the House Ag Committee. Deadline for public comment is June 14th, and you can go to the website, which is www.agriculture.house.gov.
Sort of a strange time to have every people come to Des Moines, isn't it? I mean, farmers are working 18-hour days, aren't they?
That was a closing comment from one of the farmers. He begged the committee to hold these hearings in January or February, picking springtime as the time for these hearings was a bad timing for farmers who were rushing to get their crops into the ground.
Thank you very much. Iowa Public Radio's Rob Diller joining us. He covered the hearings of the U.S. House Committee on Agriculture held last Friday at the Iowa State Fairgrounds in Des Moines. Thanks, Rob.
You're welcome, Ben.
Joining us now, Bruce Babcock. He is director of the Center for Agriculture and Rural Development and professor of economics at Iowa State University from the Iowa Public Radio studios in Ames. Good afternoon, Professor Babcock.
Good afternoon.
So let's talk about the timing, because we ended there with Rob Dillard. Why so early? We're doing the 2012 Farm Bill now, and now we put it smack dab in middle of the planting season, don't we?
We sure did, and it reflects Chairman Peterson's desire to get a head start on this Farm Bill discussion, because he thinks there's needs to be some major reworking of the Farm Bill, so he just figures he better get started with it.
Mm-hmm. So let's address not just the farmers, the producers out there, but anyone who is also not involved in agriculture. Why should we care about what happens in the Farm Bill?
Well, the most direct impact the Farm Bill has on U.S. citizens is the nutrition programs, and the most expensive or the part of the nutrition programs, the food stamp programs, and a historically large percent of the U.S. population now uses food stamps to help buy their food. And so the nutrition program is part of the Farm Bill, as is the conservation programs that are part of that affect U.S. agricultural land, and what most people think of the Farm Bill is commodity payments. And so probably the commodity payments affect U.S. citizens directly the least amount, and it's the nutrition programs that people really should be paying attention to, because that has the biggest effect on them.
So take us through this process. It started at this early date. What do we expect before we have a fully formed Farm Bill? What is the hoops what we jumped?
Well, there's a lot of hoops that need to be jumped through. The commodity groups are hard at work. When I mean commodity groups, the corn growers, soybean growers, wheat growers, dairy producers, they're all hard at work now trying to figure out what they want to see in the next Farm Bill. So that's one thing that the Senate and the House committees really look to these commodity groups for guidance about what farmers want in a Farm Bill. Another big interest group in this Farm Bill is, in fact, the environmental community, and they have a large stake in the Farm Bill because there's a lot of conservation payments, and so they're at work at figuring out what they want to see in the Farm Bill. So, and the focal point for the interest groups coming together is in the House and the Senate Ag Committees, who then put together proposals that try to meet the desires of all the interest groups that have a stake in this.
Mm-hmm. So much of our policy these days coming out of Washington is very partisan in its politics. Does this make its presence felt also in the Farm Bill?
I would say much less so historically, that it's more regional differences that matter in the Farm Bill. And you see typically the Great Plains and Upper Midwest Corn Belt legislatures from Montana down to Texas and across to Ohio up through Missouri and Arkansas and also down in the Southeast. It's the rural, it's those senators and the rural congressmen and women that are really advocates of what goes into that Farm Bill. It's much less Republican-Democrat, much more rural versus urban.
Mm-hmm. What purpose do these hearings actually serve? Because I'm thinking, are the committee members sitting there in Des Moines at the Iowa State Fairgrounds in this case really swayed by testimony? Or is it more of a show? Do they already have their own state's ag interests in mind?
It's some of both, I think. They do keep their ag interests in their states uppermost in their minds. But in fact, there is not a lot of agreement either in Washington or in rural areas about what should farm policy be. And so they really are looking to people who think about farm programs, think about conservation programs, and think deeply about it, and then bring that information to the committees to stimulate thought. So, in fact, these hearings are a way for the congressmen and women and the senators to actually try to get new ideas. And it's really the staff members who then follow up, but they really are trying to bring new ideas into play.
Do the midterm elections shape it in any way in terms of the statements made, the posturing perhaps?
A bit. Every congressman and woman wants to be able to claim they're doing constituent service, and a big constituent for rural legislators is, in fact, a farm program. So when they are seen to be doing that kind of duty, it really does help them during midterm elections. So that comes into it, too.
We have just about a minute before we have to take a break, but I think it's time enough for you to give us a brief overview. You talked about the changes we would expect to see in the next farm bill. What is going to be changed?
Well, it's too early to say what's going to be changed, but you see Chairman Peterson, Colin Peterson from Minnesota, really pushing hard to reform the farm safety net. And so right now we have five or six different programs all providing safety net coverage. And I think the chairman really wants to see if there's some common ground that could rationalize, simplify, and maybe make more efficient and less costly a better safety net for U.S. farmers.
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with our current safety net?
Well, there's nothing really wrong with it. It provides excellent coverage for farmers, but what it does is it costs a lot of money, and it's duplicative. You have private safety nets with the crop insurance. You have public safety nets. You have an hybrid safety net. So there's just a lot of safety out there, and the programs don't work together. They overlap. They cost a lot of money, and I think there's a lot of room for improvement there.
Professor Bruce Babcock, please hang on, Director of the Center for Agriculture and Rural Development and Professor of Economics at Iowa State University, joining us this hour to talk about the 2012 Farm Bill. What changes would you like to see in the next Farm Bill? Which programs are working well, in your opinion? Which do you think need a revamp? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, we'll talk with a couple of participants at this hearing on Friday, a couple of farmers here in Iowa, Beryl Bailey of Bailey Farms in Anita, also Dane Lang, a dairy farmer from Brooklyn. When we come back, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today talking about the 2012 Farm Bill. Has the Farm Bill or one of its programs benefited you? Has it made things more difficult? We'd like you to tell us your story. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Joining us now, of course, on the line, or rather in our studio still, Bruce Babcock, Director of the Center for Agricultural and Rural Development, Professor of Economics at Iowa State University. Be with us. He'll be with us throughout the hour. Joining us now, Beryl Bailey of Bailey Farms in Anita. That is in southwest Iowa. And good afternoon to you, Beryl.
Good afternoon.
Tell us about your farm.
We run a diversified corn, soybean, and grass operation. We run a beef grazing and a sheep grazing operation, and finish the lambs and the calves depending on market conditions.
Mm-hmm. So you were a participant at this hearing on Friday. What are you pushing for in the next Farm Bill?
Well, I was a lead-off witness there, and I started, I guess, with a preface was not asking for anything specific, but making a statement that farm bills are more than loan rates and food stamps. And actually, they are a visible contract between society, and agriculture. And if you look back in history, every society that's been successful has had either a written or an informal contract between the food producers and the consumers of that society. And in history, it shows that if that contract breaks down, if the trust between the producers and the consumers starts to corrode, eventually there's political unrest and society fails. So we, in a sense, both consumers and producers, are lucky that every 4 years we go about renewing that contract, revising that contract, and working to make the relationship between producers and consumers even stronger. There's always a move in the agricultural back room or discussion groups of saying, oh, we really need to get food stamps out of agriculture. We ought to just talk purely about what it's going to do for the agricultural sector. But that is really naive, because the food stamp, the nutrition part that Bruce talked about earlier, is a critical part of that agreement between agriculture and consumers. After I did that opening statement, there were about six items that I enlarged on. One is land, one is site-specific research, one on risk mitigation, one on rural infrastructure, and then foods, fads, and nutrition, and the last one is agricultural structure, oligopoly, and market fairness.
Verrill Bailey, can you tell us what do you see as broken in the current contract, or at least in need of tweaking?
Well, a number of things. One is the direction that we're headed, especially on research, is really the wrong direction. We have moved away from site-specific research, where we had high emphasis on local research farms run by land-grant universities. Now we've moved the money to a National Institute for Food and Agriculture, where the priorities are set at the national level. And really, that's big blocks of money, and so the fact is that with globalization, we need every farmer is in competition with every other farmer in the world, and his success long term depends on a steady stream of new technology that's site specific to Southwest Iowa or Central Iowa or wherever his farm has to be. So that's one area that really concerns me long term, is that we will not be as competitive as we were in the past, because of the changes in the priorities of research.
Mm-hmm. Please hang on, Verrill Bailey. I want to get another farmer into our discussion before we take another break. Dane Lang is a dairy farmer, herd manager of Yarrabee Farms in Brooklyn. That's in southeast Iowa. Good afternoon to you, Dane.
Good afternoon.
So you're a dairy farmer. We have been hearing dairy farmers have been facing huge issues because of the falling milk prices. I'm sure that was part of your testimony on Friday.
Yes, it was. That's actually about what most of my testimony was about.
So tell us about the situation. For someone not acquainted with being a dairy farmer, what have you been facing in the last few years?
Well, part of the problem was 2 or 3 years ago we had a record high price, which of course stimulated too many cows in production, and with dairy farming, we have another problem that when price drops to compensate for lost income, farmers milk more cows. So there's too many cows in the country, and so the price has kept going down, and it's gone up a little bit in the past few months, but it's still below break even. And as you said before, different commodity groups want different farm policies. Well, among dairymen, you ask two dairymen what they think should be done, and they'll give you three different answers. So consensus among dairy people of what actually needs to be done is lacking, and I can only speak for myself when we talk about policy directions, but it's been a bad couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Babcock, tell us more about the dairy industry. What is the trick from the government's perspective in terms of what we need in a good supply of milk, dairy products, and keeping those prices sufficient so that farmers like Dane Lang have a good business?
Well, that is a very tough objective to meet, is keep milk supplies up, but keep prices up too, so dairy farmers can make a living. It's a very difficult thing for government to get involved in to try to manage. And the good thing from a consumer's point of view is that dairy farmers have shown that they can outproduce any price, and that the productivity of dairy herds have been going up dramatically because of new technologies and new management techniques. So, in fact, if you're a consumer, the last thing you kind of want is the government coming in and controlling things, because dairy producers have shown that they'll produce a lot of milk given half a chance. So what's really needed, I think, for dairy policy is what to do when dairy prices collapse. And that's what happened the last couple of years or last year, that there's unprecedented loss on dairy farms. And the national dairy policy pretty much didn't do much of anything to help dairy producers out. So I think the dairy industry and Congress needs to figure out what happens when dairy farmers outproduce the market. What's going to be the national response? And again, I don't think there has been a consensus on that yet.
Okay, let's get both of your opinions on that. First, Dane Lang, how do you think the Farm Bill, the 2012, can address the crisis facing dairy farmers today?
Well, the 2012 bill won't do anything for today. And how can it change things in the future? Well, like they made clear at the hearing, there's not going to be any new money available. And as I tried to make clear at the hearing, the current methods with the counter-cyclical payments are so far below the break-even level to produce milk that they are also not useful.
Okay.
Dairymen nationwide, though, about a third, I'd say, of dairymen would like some type of supply management plan. And to do that, they have to have the government enforce it, because everybody has to be on board. And that's something 3 years ago you would never have heard a dairyman mention, some supply management.
So the government needs to be more hands-on here. Is that the consensus, Bruce Babcock?
Well, I don't think it's quite the consensus.
No, that's not my feeling either. That's just an idea on the table.
That's right. But it's an easy crutch to fall on, is if the problem is too much milk and low dairy prices, then particularly those producers that have expanded their dairy herds over the last 10 years, they would love the government to come in and manage the market for them, because they're in the market now. The problem becomes what happens in 5 years or 6 years after the government's taken kind of control of supply and demand in the dairy industry. How competitive is that industry going to be looking out into the future?
Mm-hmm. So why not, Bruce Babcock, let the market take care of this? If there's an oversupply, just let it take care of it, saying itself and correct itself.
Well, the brutality of the market has been in full force over the last year and a half in the dairy industry, as there's been a lot of dairy farmers go out of business. And that is one solution, is let the market work like that. But the pain that it has caused in many locations in the dairy industry has been dramatic and tremendous.
Dane Lang, we've got to take a break in just a moment, but tell me, how much longer can you survive the current conditions for the low milk prices?
Oh, that's hard to say. I hope indefinitely, but that's not realistic.
Okay, but suffice it to say, you're not thriving with the current milk prices.
No, we're not thriving.
Okay, please hang on. Dane Lang, a dairy farmer with us from Brooklyn, Iowa. Also with us, Verrill Bailey of Bailey Farms in Anita. That's in southwest Iowa. We want to reach out to our listeners. Has the Farm Bill or one of its programs benefited you? Has it made things more difficult? Tell us your story, what you would like to see in the coming 2012 Farm Bill. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're going to take a break for a few minutes, then come right back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, today talking about the 2012 Farm Bill. There were hearings last Friday held by the U.S. House Committee on Agriculture at the State Fairgrounds in Des Moines. We have a couple of witnesses with us who participated. Verrill Bailey of Bailey Farms in Anita with us this hour. Dane Lang, a dairy farmer from Brooklyn, Iowa. We'd like to have you join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. Has the Farm Bill benefited your farm? Has it made it more difficult for you? We'd like your story. 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Of course, also with us, Bruce Babcock, director of the Center for Agricultural and Rural Development at Iowa State University And let me start off with you, Professor Babcock. We talked a little bit about changes at the opening of the program. What changes do you believe are needed in the 2012 Farm Bill?
Well, that's a wide open question, an interesting question. What I would actually like to see is, going back to the point I made earlier, is some kind of a rationalization of this farm safety net. One of the key aspects of this contract that Verrill talked about between agriculture and the society is that when times get really tough on the farm, that the farm programs or the federal government comes to assist farmers. I think what we've seen over the last 50 years is that Congress does not want to see that link of the social contract broken. And the problem is today that we have so many different programs that are providing that kind of safety net for farmers that we're wasting a lot of money. Just give you a statistic. One of the biggest safety net programs is the crop insurance program, and that crop insurance program delivers its services through the private sector. And so what we have right now is about $2 to $3 to sometimes $4 billion a year going to the private sector to deliver risk management to farmers. But in addition to that, we have federal farm programs delivering risk management to farmers. So it seems like there needs to be a reconfiguration of the farm safety net in the next farm bill.
So it sounds like you're talking about waste. We could save money.
Well, one person's waste is another person's income, so I don't really want to call it waste because there's a lot of high-paying, good-paying rural jobs selling crop insurance and servicing the risk management needs of farmers. But if you're going to have the private sector do it, why have the public sector do it also? That's what I'm getting at. So in some sense, I think that taxpayer monies could be used more efficiently in designing a better safety net.
Verrill Bailey, you were instrumental in forming the ethanol industry in Iowa. Talk about that a little bit. How should the coming farm bill support ethanol and other biofuels in the state?
Well, the support of biofuels in the farm bill has been almost tangential. There's been pretty much spatial legislation, renewable fuel standard, and those kind of things that support it. But what's in the farm bill basically does support renewable fuels industry, and the part of the support mechanism is the support in there for the transition to cellulosic ethanol. And so there's experiments going on of growing various grasses and waste products and so forth, and investments in cooperation between the Department of Agriculture and the Energy Department and others in the technology development for the renewable fuels industry. There's no question that renewable fuels is needed. We don't know exactly how the climate change bill is going to turn out, but everything is all integrated together. And as Dr. Babcock has said, one of the problems we've got is to keep the integration of all of these programs making sense, because it's easy to get duplication and so forth that way. Actually, the last few years, the renewable fuels industry has saved the farm program billions of dollars because the new demand for corn has reduced the need for the risk mitigation portion of the farm bill to spend any money on that program. So here again, this is an integration problem that we've got to continue to work on. And I guess as we say out on the farm, there's a lot of moving parts here.
Okay, 1-866-780-9100. If you'd like to be a moving part in this discussion, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email address. Doug is joining us from Des Moines. Good afternoon, Doug.
I was part of a documentary film called Echo Heartland. And in that, some of the people that interviewed were wanting to grow something besides soybeans and corn. And yet there was something about federal and state policy policy that they claim favored the production of corn and soybeans. If we're going to have diverse crops, are we interested in diverse crops in Iowa? And if so, what kind of policy can be made that would encourage that?
Thank you, Doug. Speaking of echo, a little bit of an echo on the line, I think, made it a little difficult for you, but thank you very much, Doug, from Des Moines. Bruce Babcock, how high of a priority is that? Is it only the bottom line, or are we interested in a diversity of crops in Iowa as concerning these discussions with the U.S. Committee on Agriculture?
Well, with regards to the House Ag Committee, they're primarily interested in where the money is in current Iowa agriculture, which is corn, soybeans, hogs, and cattle. So that's the primary interest. And what Doug was talking about was that, in fact, you are allowed to grow whatever crop you want in Iowa, but you lose something called direct payments if you do that. There's restrictions on receiving those payments if you want to diversify into fruits or vegetables production. And other crops are not eligible for the farm program payment. So, in fact, there is some incentive to specialize in the things that Iowa farmers would specialize in even without those payments. Of course, it's corn and soybeans because this place is really well suited for those two crops.
Edith is joining us from Windsor Heights. Hi, Edith.
Hi there. In the current farm bill, I know there's one of the new things that was added is the acre program, sort of on a trial basis, as an alternative method of supporting farmers and giving some risk assurance. And I'm wondering, particularly for Verrill, how he feels that's worked so far.
Okay, Verrill, is it the acre program?
Well, that's a really interesting question. The acre program here in the Middle West hasn't been accepted very significantly. And in the discussion in the Q&A with Congressman Peterson, I mentioned that maybe we ought to move a couple of $1 billion that Dr. Babcock talked about appears to be excess subsidies in the crop insurance program, and maybe go down with that deal that we cut with Brazil on the problem with the cotton subsidies and put some of that money into making the acre program work a little bit better.
Let me jump in here and have you explain what the acre program is for the listeners who don't know.
Well, the acre program is almost a facsimile crop insurance program that's run by the government, and you take out that contract with the government in lieu of the countercyclical program, which basically is price driven only. And the acre program is driven on yields and price, and so it's an income insurance type program that was rolled out in the last farm bill as a test program, and the dilemma that we had when we were developing that program right at the tail end of the farm bill discussion was that we ran short of money to really finance it. And so in order to hit the budget marks for that program, the triggers that implement how much money is going to be paid and when money is going to be paid made it so that it really was, in many farmers' eyes, was a greater risk over the 4 years of that contract to go into the acre program than it was to stay with the old price-only type program. So If the trigger points are changed and the regulations are modified, and again the budget ramifications would probably be greater, I think that mechanism is the way that we ought to go to hit some of Dr. Babcock's goals of rationalizing what we're doing here in risk mitigation with government programs.
About 10 minutes left of our discussion. I want to reach out to our listeners once again and ask, has the farm bill benefited your farm? Has it made things more difficult? Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Professor Babcock, anything to add to that assessment of the acre program that Verrill had?
No, Verrill did a good description of the acre program, and I think if you wanted to adjust that program to provide an income insurance program, you might want to put that at the county level. Yeah, right now, what it does is it triggers if the state yield is low, and there's a lot of variation in yields across counties, so a lot of counties can suffer a loss without the state triggering. And so putting it at the county level, I think, would do a better job, and I think it would lead the way towards some of this rationalization, because if the federal government is providing some kind of income insurance at the county level, then the crop insurance industry could provide any additional risk management benefits that farmers need at the farm level. And so they could pick up where the federal government leaves off.
I want to touch on the aspect that we hear a lot about, the consolidation and concentration in agriculture. Go to Dane. We haven't been to Dane for a moment. What do you think about that? Do you think there are too few companies controlling too much in agriculture these days?
Well, I worry about the future of the dairy industry, that it'll become vertically integrated just like chickens and beef, where a few small processors control, 99% of the meat that's produced in the country. It's completely possible to milk 100,000 cows on one dairy. Nobody's milked that many quite yet, but there's one in Idaho with 72,000 cows. I mean, that's a lot of milk, and a person that milks 40 cows can't compete with that kind of scale that a large dairy like that has. So is there too few companies? Maybe. Can it happen to any industry? Yes, I'm confident it can. Is it a good thing? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that.
How many do you milk?
Oh, about 500.
Mm-hmm. Verrill Bailey, what is your view on the consolidation in agriculture?
Well, I think it's one of the hazards, Dana basically paraphrased it really good in the dairy industry. Basically, when I started farming, we produced broilers, we produced laying hens, we had farrow to finish, we milked cows, we're really diversified when I was a kid, and as the poultry was vertically integrated, and the big dairies grew out, not completely integrated. But in 1998, when the price of hogs really collapsed, and it became obvious that vertical integration was going to be the way to go, they basically almost eliminated hogs out of our area of the country. They did eliminate all of the sows out. So what we're talking about when we have this type of consolidation is massive restructuring and changing of rural America, because you don't have near as many implement stores, near as many hardware stores, or many veterinarians or anything else, support industry, and it really hollows out the main street of small towns in rural America when that vertical integration takes place. Now, the flip side is it better on the consumer side? Is it better for Walmart to deliver that product from those big vertically integrated companies and the consumers benefit? The problem becomes the ultimate risk that we just saw in the banking industry. Can they get too big to fail? And I don't think we've quite faced that in agriculture and food production, but the way things are going, we could. And so these are the questions that run around in the back of my head that I see are a risk of simply allowing things to continue on down the road the way they have in the last 40 years.
Bruce Babcock, on this topic, I'm looking at a quote from Chairman Peterson from this last Friday. He said, "I don't think we should be subsidizing someone just to stay small. That just doesn't make sense." So for the farm bill, that's not really even on the table, that the desirability from a cultural point of view, this hollowing out, is that a concern that can be supported so that we don't just have huge agro-industry?
Well, it is a concern, and you see the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, talking about it wherever he goes in terms of what do we want rural America to look like. But, this consolidation is not just happening in rural America and not in agriculture. It's happening in every industry that the United States around the world. You just saw United merge with Continental. You saw Delta merge with Northwest. You see the automobile industries merging. You're seeing this merger and consolidation happen everywhere. So it's more than just agriculture and food production. It's happening economy-wide because the economies of scale are such that the bigger companies have an advantage.
Doug is joining us from Knoxville. Hello, Doug. Welcome to our program.
Hello. Great program. Great topic. Couple points I'd like to raise that other people should maybe consider in the agriculture bill is, first of all, is income itself. I'd like to see some more programs focused on rural development other than farming. And as a farm owner myself and as a part-time operator, I think we all know agriculture has been pretty lucrative the last few years. However, rural Iowa's dirty little secret is there's a lot of poor people in the rural areas. Mm-hmm. Aren't involved in agriculture. The other point I'd like to make is conservation. I think we farm a lot of ground in Iowa that maybe needs to be taken out of production. 20 years ago when I first moved here, you know, there was programs in place to limit some row crop farming on lands that were highly erodible. I think a lot of that's gone away, and I'd like to see it come back.
Doug, let's challenging phone line there you gave us, but thank you. We got the points. Doug joining us from Knoxville. Let's touch on those two before we have to go in the remaining 5 minutes or so. Bruce Babcock, rural development, other than agriculture, is that addressed by the Farm Bill?
It is in terms of funding loan programs in USDA for rural businesses. And funded that way, and they are making investments in communication. They're trying to make investments in transportation and those kinds of things that can help any business in rural America.
Okay, and the other topic that was addressed there, conservation. Are we likely to see that changing in the coming Farm Bill?
I don't think you're going to see it changing because there's a very large constituency out there, the environmental community, and a very large recognition by farm groups themselves that the conservation provisions of the Farm Bill help them. We just heard about the need to not farm fence row to fence row and put the most sensitive ground either out of production or to adopt management practices on that land that minimize environmental effects. I think there's broad recognition that those things are very key features of the Farm Bill, and I think we'll see them maintained, if not strengthened, moving forward.
Beryl Bailey, I think some of your testimony touched on these two topics, didn't it?
Well, yeah, I'll hit the conservation one first. The dilemma that we have, and we had this happen in the last Farm Bill, is there was a significant amount of money went into conservation and the kinds of things that the caller referred to. The dilemma is that if anything comes along, it seems like the disaster programs take precedence over conservation. So we're losing hundreds of millions of dollars out of the conservation program in the last Farm Bill. To try and use for other purposes, and so this is one dilemma that we have, and I don't know how you get around it. It's just politics as usual. On the other area of rural infrastructure, I hit some areas that in my testimony that are not normally covered. One is broadband, and the fact that we need net neutrality on the internet and some way of causing or doing like we had to do way back with the telephone industry in order to deliver good service to everyone in the country, and so somehow working the broadband need in rural America is a big one. The other one we've got, and maybe this will be handled in the climate change bill, but we have real problems, bureaucratic problems out here of building wind turbines out on our farms and getting our electricity on the grid. And one problem I had this morning is that the global positioning system, which is really critical for agriculture, is degrading. I, in a half a mile run, I had a 3-foot variance in my GPS signal this morning. And so this is one thing that again, is not in the Farm Bill, but somehow the people in agriculture need to stand up and say, we've got to work on that infrastructure.
Okay.
And I also I also mentioned about the cell phone system that, the private sector is not giving universal service in cell phones out here, and the government may have to step in on that one.
Okay, we have to, in your opinion, beef up the high tech in rural America. Bruce Babcock, let me give you the last word, the last minute or so. Can you give us a picture of farming in the future, the next 10 to 20 years, assuming that some of the trends continue? How will it be different than today?
Well, the biggest trend we've seen in the last 10 or 20 years is widespread adoption in the livestock industry of bigger, better managed, lower cost farming operations. Doug was just talking about a 500, or Dane was talking about 500-acre dairy operation in Iowa. If you look 10 years ago, there were just a handful, if that, 500-cow dairy operations. And that's a small operation if you look at where investments are taking place now. So if you continue that trend out into the future, I think you are going to see fewer farmers working the land. You're going to see fewer livestock producers and increased consolidation. And I think that if you look at where the farm bill is going with that, is maybe to wonder if that is going to be counterbalanced at all by new initiatives in the rural development and in the rural infrastructure. So that's kind of what I see as the picture coming forth.
Professor Bruce Babcock of Iowa State University, I want to thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Also, Verrill Bailey of Bailey Farms in Anita, and Dane Lang, a dairy farmer from Brooklyn. Thanks to the both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt, our producer assistant today, Lindsay Moon. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.